Thanks for doing your part to support your public radio station. A while back, I had the pleasure of speaking with author and conservationist Terry Tempest Williams about her home state of Utah. It has many of America's most impressive and beloved natural wonders and national parks. It's also a place where the role of public lands is being hotly contested. Terry Tempest Williams has played a vocal role in this debate, and she told me why she's so passionate about Utah's public lands.
Utah is bedrock. It's family. It's where the bones of my ancestors dwell. Six generations. I come from a Mormon family. My roots for an American Westerner who is white are deep, and my devotion is very real.
For people who care about the environment, you just lay awake at night thinking, what can I do? You actually purchased land in order to save it from drilling. Can you explain about that initiative on the part of you and your husband?
Yes, it was the quarterly oil and gas auction, lease auction in Salt Lake City, Utah, where members of the oil and gas industry come to bid on leases that then they will develop for fossil fuels. Brooke and I made the decision as citizens to purchase some of those oil and gas leases, which we did. We bought two leases, 1,120 acres on a remnant sale. They were not leases that the oil and gas companies wanted or chose to bid on. We purchased them at a discount of $1.50 an acre, if you can imagine that. Our public lands for sale to lease oil and gas for $1.50. That's less than a cup of coffee. We were asked what kind of energy we were going to develop, and I said, you can no longer define what energy means to us. The energy we wish to develop at this moment in time is the energy to fuel a movement to keep our fossil fuels in the ground. Our leases have been denied. The Bureau of Land Management did not give us the leases on the grounds of our intent not to drill for oil. We said that we would drill for oil as soon as science could show us that the oil and gas was worth more above ground than below, given the costs of climate to our future. What we also said is that the oil and gas companies have no desire or design to develop those leases that they've purchased until the price of oil rises. So we feel we have been treated unfairly, and we have appealed the Bureau of Land Management's decision. Our case will go before the Board of Appeals in the Department of Interior.
Now, what if I just think, well, there's a real need, energy independence, jobs, the economy?
But I think it's about long-term concerns and short-term gain, and look at who stands to benefit if our national monuments are opened up for fossil fuel companies. Bernard DeVoto, who wrote for Harper's Magazine, wrote in 1951, quote, "You had better watch this now and from now on. The land grabbers are on the loose again, and they can be stopped only as they were before, by the effective marshaling of public opinion." We're there. And I love these words of Wallace Stegner that was in the same era, 1955, the year I was born, where he says, quote, "It is a better world with some buffalo left in it, a richer world with some gorgeous canyons unmarred by signboards, hot dog stands, superhighways, or high-tension lines, undrowned by power or irrigation reservoirs. If we preserved as parks only those places that have no economic possibilities, we would have no parks. And in the decades to come, it will not be only the buffalo and the trumpeter swan who need sanctuaries. Our own species is going to need them too. It needs them now."
That's Terry Tempest Williams, author of The Hour of Land, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, Desert Quartet, and many other books, all rooted in the American West. The fishing village of Petty Harbor on the island of Newfoundland in Canada is a far cry from the deserts of Utah. But Alan Doyle is equally passionate about the place he calls home. He's a popular singer, musician, and actor, and the lead singer for the folk rock band Great Big Sea. Alan's written two best-selling books about his island, Where I Belong and A Newfoundlander in Canada. We've found that his music and his writings are filled with his love for his sometimes quirky island home.
We're one of the few places in the world that have our own time zone, yeah. And so we're 30 minutes ahead of Atlantic Canada. So that puts us 90 minutes ahead of Toronto, New York, and everything in the Eastern time zone. So I was, you know, where I was at least in a half an hour or 90 minutes ahead of everybody else.
Somebody told me that was just because Newfoundland wanted not to be forgotten by the rest of Canada. So every time they say 6 o'clock tonight, 6:30 in Newfoundland or something like that.
Yeah. One of the things that I talk about in that book you mentioned called The Newfoundlander in Canada, the most recent book, is about discovering for myself as an islander how far out in the ocean Newfoundland is. You know, because if you grow up like on an island, you spend your young life trying to convince yourself and everybody else that it's not that far away from everything.
Right.
You know, until you start traveling and you go, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
It actually is quite a ways from everything.
And it's cut off in more than geographic terms. I mean, when your grandfather was a kid, a Canadian was somebody who lived in the country, the next country over, right?
That's right. Well, in the weird twist of history and politics for me and my father were born in the exact same little fishing town called Petty Harbor. But me and my father were born in different countries. And he was born a Canadian. I'm a first-generation Canadian. Huh. My father was almost 10 years old when Newfoundland voted to join Canada, right? And, of course, my grandfather would have been, you know, an adult at that point and would have voted in that vote to give away Newfoundland's independence or not. And I don't need to wonder how he voted because he told me a lot. Well, and it wasn't to join another country. It was to keep our own, you know. But, of course, I was born in Canada, right? So in the oddest twist of fate, I'm a first-generation Canadian.
Newfoundland joined in 1949, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And it was a close vote.
51-49, yeah. Yeah. And a much kind of one of those twists of history, a much controversial vote that, you know, recounts were demanded that were never had and all that kind of stuff, all lending itself to the sort of Republican conspiracy theorists of my, you know, my grandfather's generation.
What are some ways that Newfoundlanders are unique to Newfoundland as opposed to the rest of Canada?
I think the first things I would talk about is in music and art and culture and the things that people, the humanity of it all. The settlement patterns here in Newfoundland, of course, primarily came from southern England and southern Ireland, you know, other than the First Nations and Indigenous people. But 550-odd years ago, southern Irish and southern English fishermen started coming over here in the summertime and started fishing the cod stocks. And then slowly but surely, they started staying through the winter, which must have sounded crazy at the time, you know, in the 1600s or whatever, to say we're going to stay in Newfoundland for the winter. And that's how the coasts of Newfoundland became populated. And so the traditions, the music, the food, and the accents that came from whatever part of the UK or Ireland that you might have come from kind of stayed, right? And so they became fixed in time. So there are accents in Newfoundland that are like parts of Southern Ireland were, you know, in the 1600s. And those accents probably don't even exist over there anymore. But so it was isolated. And up until very, very recently, you know, Newfoundland, like my parents grew up in, you know, the 1950s and 60s in Newfoundland with really only exposure to the tiniest little bit of Canada or to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Most of the experience and stuff was still came from the other way.
So it was European facing.
Yeah.
I read in your book about kitchen parties. That's kind of cool, where people just hang out in the kitchen.
One of the great things about being a song fella, a singer, a songwriter or whatever from Newfoundland is that it's one of the places that's recorded its history, not exclusively in song, but primarily in song. Mm. And, you know, again, because a lot of the communities around the coast didn't have a library, they didn't have a newspaper. So they had, you know, they recorded their history in ways that they could remember. So often that was in stories and songs and recitations and, you know, you combine that with the fact that these communities really had to be their own entertainment, right? If they wanted to have a dance on Friday, there was nobody rolling in on a bus, you know, to play for them. So they had to do it themselves. So in a lot of those communities, even as recently as a generation ago, you would go to a dance in one of those small towns and the music and the songs that you might hear would be probably really exclusive to that town. You know, and that's amazing to think of. So, I mean, to make a long story short, I mean, one of the great ways I think that if you want to learn about Newfoundland and you don't want to read 10 books, you can always just learn 10 Newfoundland songs.
Yeah.
And you'll learn a lot through them.
Alan, I love how you write about your first job out of high school when you were cutting fish tongues.
Cutting cod tongues, yeah. I had a very lucky childhood to grow up in a fishing town in Newfoundland that really still had the economy and culture. I mean, I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, but I kind of had the same childhood as my father because Newfoundland in Petty Harbor then was still entrenched in the inshore small boat cod fishery. So that meant that my little town had a couple of fish plants that for 5 or 6 months of the year basically ran 24 hours producing the codfish that came in small 20-foot boats, you know, at 1,000 pounds or 800 pounds at a time. And, you know, the entire community would be involved in that wow. in that fishery for basically 24 hours a day for 6 months of the year. So that included the 10-year-olds. So I was born in 1969. So in 1979, every summer day, I would get up and run down to the wharf, leave my house at 6 or 7:30 in the morning with a bucket, a sharp knife, and go. And I would stand on the wharf, and our job, the young fellas' job in the community, was to help the fishermen when they landed their boats. If you helped them clean the tables, clean their boats, unload the boats and stuff, then you could cut out the cod tongues, which you could then sell for, you know, not an insignificant amount of money as a 10-year-old in 1979.
Cod tongues, were those considered the delicacy, or they?
Yeah, I mean, they still are kind of thing. It's really just the texture of it would be much akin to like a scallop, if you ever seen like Atlantic Canadian scallop kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they're fry and they're fantastic. And we used to sell them to local restaurants from St. John's or from, you know, to tourists or to whatever. And the thing I come up with in both books really is that I had no idea that such a specific skill set, such a specific tiny little thing would teach me lessons as a young kid that I could take with me almost for the rest of my life and be tremendously beneficial, you know. Most people talk about learning lessons the hard way, and I would say, well, I learned mine the easy way. I didn't even know I was learning them, right? And I'm like, for example, as a 10-year-old, I was participating in the economy of the town.
Mm-hmm.
I was part of it. It needed me, and I needed it. Not to mention the simple rules of like, if I get up earlier and work harder, I will do better. If I work harder with a team and we organize and do this together, we all do better. If I'm fair and honest with people in selling and buying and cutting and teamwork, everybody benefits. Who knew, you know, that that would serve me well as a musician traveling Germany,
yeah.
you know, but
yeah.
it's like, but of course it does.
That's Canadian musician, actor, and author Alan Doyle on his home island of Newfoundland. My hometown sits on the other side of the continent, as far west as you can get without swimming. Edmonds, it's just a little town built up around a ferry dock, maybe nothing worth raving about in some guidebook. But it's the place I'm always glad to return to, no matter how far I roam, and no matter how many wonderful people and places I encounter elsewhere. I believe it's important to have a sense of home wherever that may be, and to take good care of it. For me, that means looking out for my community. That requires understanding it, and knowing what issues are affecting me and my neighbors. In order to be the best citizen I can be, I count on reliable news sources that bring me balanced, informed perspectives about what's happening down the road, as well as on the other side of the world. In these complicated times, public media provide the kind of clarity that helps all of us be better citizens. During this special fundraising edition of Travel with Rick Steves, we're asking you to help ensure that this station stays strong. With your gift, you can make a huge difference right now by helping ensure that this one-of-a-kind programming can keep coming to you and to everyone in your community, day in and day out. We're holding this membership campaign today because the station that brings you Travel with Rick Steves relies on the financial support of people like you. That's how we continue to bring you the quality and the substance you expect every time you turn to this place on your dial. Please, can we hear from you right now? We're counting on you.